Hi, I'm Dave Summers, and welcome to AMA's Edgewise, where you will hear fresh insights from recognized thought leaders across a wide range of subject matter. AMA's Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Whether you're a CEO, a parent, or merely a person who wants to make a difference, you probably wish you had more influence with the people in your life. But most of us stop trying to make change happen because we believe it is too difficult, if not impossible. But this is about to change. From the authors of Crucial Conversations comes Influencer, a book that combines insights of behavioral scientists and business leaders with stories of high-powered influencers from all walks of life. Joining us today is one of the authors of Influencer, Joseph Grenny. Joseph is the co-founder of Vital Smarts, an innovator in corporate training, which has helped more than 300 of the Fortune 500 companies through performance behavioral development. Joe, welcome to Edgewise. You say that the first step to achieving lasting influence is finding vital behaviors. So what do you mean by that?
One of the things we've learned by studying people that have solved world-scale problems in a world-class way is that they all start by trying to identify vital behaviors. That's two or three behaviors that lead to enormous change. For example, a person who is credited with starting a campaign that saved 100,000 lives in hospitals across the United States did so by focusing on just a handful of behaviors of doctors and nurses. These vital behaviors tend to produce a massive amount of change, and they give us enormous leverage if we can find them. Dr. Donald Berwick of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement looked at these alarming statistics. The number six leading cause of death in the United States is medical mistakes. One of the most likely ways you can be killed in the United States is to get sick and go to a hospital and then have somebody make a mistake in your treatment. This is a horrendous statistic. A couple of 100,000 people are killed every year by their health care in the United States. So the Institute for Healthcare Improvement wanted to understand what are some of the vital behaviors for solving that problem. And they found that there are six. There are six things which, if you could get doctors and nurses to do consistently in organizations across the United States, he estimated that you could save 100,000 lives. Now, the real trick here is not just identifying those vital behaviors, it's then trying to create an influence strategy to get people to do them, especially when you have no authority. Donald Berwick doesn't lead any hospital. None of the doctors or nurses in the world report to him, and yet he was able to develop an influence strategy to get these six vital behaviors to happen consistently, and within 18 months was able to save over 100,000 lives in U.S. hospitals by changing these behaviors. One of them, for example, healthcare specialists for years have known that one of the leading causes of death in hospitals is postoperative infection. After you've been operated on, your wound gets infected. They also know that one of the behaviors that will help avert those infections is clipping instead of shaving. So rather than shaving an area that's about to be cut into, what they need to do is use clippers. Just clip the hair as short as they can. This reduces the likelihood of nicks, and people that are involved are less likely to transmit germs and so on. This is the one thing. Now, it's been known for 30 years, but nobody could get this to happen in hospitals across the U.S. So one of the most important things about vital behaviors is identifying the handful of behaviors that lead to the most improvement in the shortest amount of time. The rest of the book then deals with how do you create an influence strategy to implement those behaviors.
Could you give us a little bit of a taste of how you would create an influence strategy to change those behaviors?
There are six sources of influence that you have to marshal in order to be able to make change inevitable. It is literally possible to change most any human behavior if these six sources of influence are aligned together. The big mistake you and I tend to make is that we try to identify one or two sources of influence and throw them at a problem. So, for example, let's say we wanted people to clip instead of shaving in hospitals across the United States. One of the failed strategies that we tend to use is just rolling out a whole bunch of new awareness training about how clipping is important. And then 2 years later, when we find that nobody's complying with that, we go back and we try the same thing again. So what we've assumed is that just increasing skills would make a difference. Now, you probably don't have time for us to elaborate on all six of these sources of influence, but let me just mention a couple. The first is making sure there's a moral imperative around it, that people experience the human consequences so they get in their gut the need to change. The second is improving skills. Very often, it isn't that people don't know they're supposed to clip, it's that they don't know how or they don't know the differences. We often underinvest in skill building when what we need to be doing is overinvesting in it. Third is social influence. It's making sure that people are modeling and holding others accountable for this kind of behavior in an organization, particularly leaders and opinion leaders. Another is making sure there are penalties and incentives that foster the behavior. And finally, it's making sure the environment is structured to foster these behaviors. Are the clippers hard to find and misplaced frequently? Are they often not sterile, whereas the shaving instruments are around and accessible? What is accessible and what is available is what becomes used. So looking at all of these sources of influence and aligning our environment is essential in helping to make the vital behaviors become inevitable.
In the rush to set objectives and strategies to meet goals, you overlook the barriers that need to change. Can behaviors themselves become part of the personal objectives that need to be fulfilled as performance measures?
I'll give you a quick example. You look at organizations that have done a really good job influencing behavior change. Southwest Airlines is a terrific example. They're succeeding not just because they developed a strategy of using a certain size aircraft with interchangeable parts. Many others have copied that but have nowhere near caught up. The reason is because Southwest has perfected an influence strategy to shape the behavior of its employees. It's built into the incentive systems, it's built into objectives and the performance appraisal, it's trained to them, they're given the sort of moral imperative that helps them understand why these are important, there's peer pressure involved. Multiple sources of influence come together to shape that. And here's the big mistake business leaders make. They'll go benchmark a Southwest Airlines or a Toyota manufacturing organization. They write down reams and reams of notes about what they see, and then they come back and implement one or two ideas. It doesn't work that way. Human behavior is shaped by multiple sources of influence, and unless you bring back all of those sources of influence, you won't see the same behavior that you saw when you went on your benchmarking trip. So I think that one of those powerful sources is what you're identifying there, building into the performance appraisal a behavioral expectation, letting people know they're accountable not just for results but behaviors. That's one very important source of influence, but only one.
Okay, let's talk about pitfalls. In your book, you talk about a flaw that you say is common in failed influence strategies, which is the flaw of confusing outcomes with behavior.
The vast majority of us fail in our influence efforts because we just focus on outcomes. So, for example, I say I want to lose 20 pounds, or I want to get fit, or I want to change my diet. Or in a customer service setting, we say we want to improve customer service by 10%. And then when we ask, all right, how are we going to do that? We leap immediately to strategies. We say, well, we're going to roll out new customer service training, and we're going to offer bonuses to groups that have better customer service in their departments. Well, what you've done is you just skip the whole middle element, which is the essence of influence, and that's identifying the vital behaviors you want to change. We worked with one organization that was doing very poorly on getting new products to market. So they were coming in years late and hundreds of millions of dollars over budget at times, and they wanted to figure out how to get them to market on time, on budget, and on spec. And once again, they made this same mistake. They leapt right from the outcome, we want to improve project performance by 50%, to a whole bunch of potential solutions without looking at the behaviors that were making a difference. They said, let's implement this project governance organization. Let's develop new software to try to track our projects. What they didn't do was stop and say, what are the vital behaviors that profoundly and predictably affect project outcomes or customer service or my weight or my financial well-being? Identifying those vital behaviors is a crucial step that most people tend to skip.
So your findings show that the vital behavior approach is applicable not just to organizations, but also to individuals who want to overcome a personal limitation or problem. How can someone use the vital behavior approach to solve their own problems or to improve their own performance?
Personal problems, relationship problems, there are vital behaviors that affect all of these. One marriage scholar that we write in the book about identified the four vital behaviors that profoundly affect the quality of a relationship, a marriage, a family. And if you can spot these four behaviors and develop a strategy for changing these behaviors, it improves your likelihood of having a rich and flourishing relationship by 50%. So even in relationships, there are vital behaviors. And once again, the strategy for identifying these is, first of all, looking for good research out there, but then also conducting your own positive deviant study, identifying where in your life you get off the rails and how you get back on, or identifying how others you see who seem to be doing differently than you do the same thing. The same would occur with personal finances. So we describe in the book how you can look for the critical moments that most affect your financial well-being and recognize what are the vital behaviors you need to change in yourself. So I might, for example, find that I stick with my budget pretty well, but around bonus time, when I'm feeling a little flush with cash, in fact, 2 weeks before it, I'm looking at the Sharper Image catalog a whole lot more often than I probably ought to. So that becomes the critical moment when I have to look at what are the behaviors I need to enact now so that I don't blow the whole bonus and miss the opportunity to try to create a better financial plan for myself.
The book again is Influencer. And Joseph Grunning, thanks for joining us today. It's time for You've Been Spotted, where we interview random people who are attending a workshop or seminar at one of our 5 executive conference centers. For more information on our executive conference centers and seminars, please visit our website, www.amanet.org. And now here's Kevin Lee.
I'm at AMA Seminar, Building Better Work Relationships, New Techniques for Results-Oriented Communication, taught by Barbara Bijou. I'm finding out what key behaviors to success participants are discovering.
I work for a large international law firm. Over the years, I've realized that my communication style is a little bit different, coming from a technical background. It didn't really actually prepare me for a lot of the people-related skills that I need, so I think I need to read it to reevaluate how I actually communicate with people. And just telling somebody to do something, there's so much more beyond it and behind it that we just take for granted. Sometimes we just really forget on a daily basis.
I work in the IT field for a healthcare provider, and generally I'm a good communicator, but I do sometimes respond a little quickly to people. So we're looking at ways to improve both internal communications in the IT side and communications with the people within the hospital. So learning more about how you communicate and what styles you are and other people are could definitely be helpful in better communication.
I'm Barbara Bijou, and I'm the facilitator for Building Better Work Relationships. A lot of people come in, they're lone rangers, and they leave as team players. That's a big shift. One woman today said to me, Monday morning, I'm going to bring breakfast to my team. It's the first time she's ever thought she needed to socialize with her group. So yes, that's a big shift for people. There's some gems that people immediately get and put into action. And part of this is for them to create an action plan, something they could start on as soon as they're done with the course. And a lot of them actually start doing it before the course is even finished.
I think what this course is trying to really drive at is that communication, A, it's an art form, and B, it's a two-way street. In order for you to actually accomplish what you want, to get what you want, you need to be able to communicate that to other people, but also try to make sure that the person gets what they want, and actually create like a win-win situation for everyone through communication. I think that's what it really is instilling in me.
There's a personality inventory that you take on the second day of the course, 40 questions, and questions are broken down into categories, and it determines whether you're assertive, passive, aggressive, or passive-aggressive, basically. The results are invariably surprising. And it really shows you what you need to work on.
I know of a couple of coworkers that I could work with that I could probably adjust myself a little bit more to their styles. I think that evaluating yourself and your coworkers to see how do I like people to talk to me and how do I normally talk to other people versus what do other people actually want to hear and how do they respond to certain stimuli, I think that's something that a lot of people really need to work on in the workplace.
It would be great to hear your feedback on this program, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.